big energy levels, as if Pyrrhus's window opened more easily to balls thrown at only certain speeds. This phenomenon is known as resonance. The confusion Plachek delighted in reporting concerned a resonance in the capture cross-sections of uranium and thorium. Plachek pointed out that uranium and thorium both exhibit a capture resonance for neutrons with medium-range energies of about 25 electron volts. That meant, first of all, that although fission was one behavior uranium could exhibit under neutron bombardment, capture and subsequent transmutation continued to be another. Bohr was not ever to be rid of those inconvenient transuranians. Some of them were real. If a neutron penetrated a uranium nucleus, for example, the result might be fission. But if the neutron happened to be traveling at the appropriate energy when it penetrated, somewhere around 25 eV, the nucleus would probably capture it without fissioning. Beta decay would follow, increasing the nuclear charge by one unit. The result should be a new, as yet unnamed, transuranic element of atomic number 93. That was one of Plachek's points. It would prove in time to be crucial. The other source of confusion was more straightforward. It was also more immediately relevant to the question of how to harness nuclear energy. It concerned differences between uranium and thorium. Thorium, element 90, a soft, heavy, lustrous, silver-white metal, was first isolated by the celebrated Swedish chemist Jans Jakob Berzelius in 1828. Berzelius named the new element after Thor, the Norse god of thunder. Its oxide found commercial use beginning in the late 19th century as the primary component of the fragile woven mantles of gas lanterns. Heat incandesces it a brilliant white. Because it is mildly radioactive, and radioactivity was once considered tonic, thorium was also for some years incorporated into a popular German toothpaste, Duramat. Auer, the company that made German gas mantles, also made the toothpaste. Hahn, Meitner, and Strassmann, the Joliot-Curies, and others had regularly studied thorium alongside uranium. Its behavior was often similar. Otto Frisch had first demonstrated that it fissioned. He bombarded it next after uranium in the course of his January experiment in Copenhagen, the experiment he had discussed with Bohr after he returned from Kungälv and Bohr had worked so hard in the United States to protect. Frisch was then also first to notice that the fission characteristics of thorium differed from those of uranium. Thorium did not respond to the magic of paraffin. It was unaffected by slow neutrons. Richard B. Roberts and his colleagues at the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism of the Carnegie Institution of Washington had just independently confirmed and extended Frisch's findings. With their 5 million volt Van de Graaff, they could generate neutrons of several different known energies. Continuing their experiments after their Saturday night show for the Washington Conference Group, they had compared uranium and thorium fission responses at varying energies, as Frisch, with his single neutron source, could not. They found, to their surprise, Frisch's paper had not yet appeared in Nature, that while both uranium and thorium fissioned under bombardment by fast neutrons, only uranium fissioned under bombardment by slow neutrons. Some energy, between 0.5 MeV and 2.5 MeV, marked a lower threshold for fast neutron fission for both elements. Bohr and John Wheeler, beginning work at Princeton on fission theory, had estimated the threshold energy to be about 1 MeV. The slow neutrons that also fissioned uranium were effective at far lower energies. From these comparisons, the DTM group concluded in a February paper, it appears that the uranium fissions are produced by different processes for fast and slow neutrons. Why, Plachek now prodded Bohr, should both uranium and thorium have similar capture resonances and similar fast neutron thresholds but different responses to slow neutrons? If the liquid drop model had any validity at all, the difference made no sense. Bohr abruptly saw why and was struck dumb. Not to lose what he had only barely grasped, oblivious to courtesy, he pushed back his chair and strode from the room and from the club. Rosenfeld hurried to follow. Taking a hasty leave of Plachek, I joined Bohr, who was walking silently, lost in deep meditation, which I was careful not to disturb. The two men tramped speechless through the snow across the Princeton campus to Fine Hall, the neo-Gothic brick building where the Institute for Advanced Study was then lodged. They went in to Bohr's office, borrowed from Albert Einstein. It was spacious, with leaded windows, a fireplace, a large blackboard, an oriental rug to warm the floor. No peripatetic like Bohr, Einstein had judged it too large and moved into a small secretarial annex nearby. As soon as we entered the office, Rosenfeld remembers, Bohr rushed to the blackboard, telling me, "Now listen, I have it all." And he started, again without uttering a word, drawing graphs on the blackboard. In the first graph Bohr drew, the horizontal axis plotted neutron energy left to right, low to high, slow to fast. The vertical axis charted cross-sections, the probability of a particular nuclear reaction, and served a double purpose. The lazy S that filled most of the frame represented thorium's cross-section for capture at different neutron energies, the steep central peak demonstrating the 25 eV resonance in the middle range. The tail that waved from the horizontal axis on the right side represented a different thorium cross-section, its cross-section for fission beginning at that high 1 MeV threshold. What Bohr had drawn was thus a visualization of thorium's changing response to bombardment by neutrons of increasing energy. Bohr moved to the next section of blackboard and drew a second graph. He labeled it with the mass number of the isotope most plentiful in natural uranium. He wrote the mass number 238 with very large figures, Rosenfeld says. He broke several pieces of chalk in the process. Bohr's urgency marked the point of his insight. The second graph looked exactly like the first. But a third graph was coming. Francis Aston had found only U-238 when he first passed uranium through his mass spectrograph at the Cavendish. In 1935, using a more powerful instrument, physicist Arthur Jeffrey Dempster of the University of Chicago detected a second, lighter isotope. "It was found," Dempster announced in a lecture, "that a few seconds' exposure was sufficient for the main component at 238 reported by Dr. Aston. But on long exposures, a faint companion of mass number 235 was also present." 3 years later, a gifted Harvard postdoctoral fellow named Alfred Otto Karl Neyer, the son of working-class German emigrants to Minnesota, measured the ratio of U-235 to U-238 in natural uranium as 1 to 139, which meant that U-235 was present to the extent of about 0.7%. By contrast, thorium in its natural form is essentially all one isotope, Th232, and that natural difference in the composition of the two elements was the clue that set Bohr off. He drew his third graph. It depicted one cross-section, not two. Having made a hard copy of his abrupt vision, Bohr was finally ready to explain himself. Both thorium and U-238 could be expected on theoretical grounds to behave similarly, he pointed out to Rosenfeld, to fission only with fast neutrons above 1 MeV. And it seemed that they did. That left U-235. It followed as a matter of logic, Bohr said triumphantly, that U-235 must be responsible for slow neutron fission. Such was his essential insight. He went on to explore the subtle energetics of the several reactions. Thorium was lighter than U-235, U-238 heavier, but the middle isotope differed more significantly in another important regard. When Th-232 absorbed a neutron, it became a nucleus of odd mass number, Th-233. When U-238 absorbed a neutron, it also became a nucleus of odd mass number, U-239. But when U-235 absorbed a neutron, it became a nucleus of even mass number, U-236. And the vicissitudes of nuclear rearrangement are such, as Fermi would explain one day in a lecture, that changing from an odd number of neutrons to an even number of neutrons, released 1 or 2 MeV, which meant that U-235 had an inherent energetic advantage over its two competitors. It accrued energy toward fission simply by virtue of its change of mass. They did not. Lise Meitner and Otto Frisch had realized in Kungälv that a certain amount of energy was necessary to agitate the nucleus to fission, but they had not considered in detail the energetics of that input. They were distracted by the enormous 200 MeV output. In fact, the uranium nucleus required an input of about 6 MeV to fission. That much energy was necessary to roil the nucleus to the point where it elongated and broke apart. The absorption of any neutron, regardless of its velocity, made available a binding energy of about 5.3 MeV. But that left U-238 about 1 MeV short, which is why it needed fast neutrons of at least that threshold energy before it could fission. U-235 also earned 5.3 MeV when it absorbed a neutron, but it won Fermi's 1 or 2 MeV in addition simply by adjusting from an odd to an even mass. That put its total above 6 MeV. So any neutron at all would fission U-235, slow, fast, or in between, which was what Bohr's third graph demonstrated. The probably continuous fission cross-section of U-235. From slow neutrons on the left, only a fraction of an electron volt above zero energy, to fast neutrons on the right above 1 MeV that would also fission U-238. Any neutron an atom of U-235 encountered would agitate it to fission. Natural uranium masked U-235's continuous fissibility. The more abundant U-238 captured most of the neutrons. Only by slowing the neutrons with paraffin below the U-238 capture resonance at 25 EV had experimenters like Hahn, Strassmann, and Frisch been able to coax the highly fissionable U-235 out of hiding. In a burst of insight, Bohr had answered Plotchek's objections and replenished his liquid drop. In January, Bohr had produced a 700-word paper in 3 days to protect his European colleagues' priorities. Now, in his eagerness to spread the news of U-235's special role in fission, he produced an 1,800-word paper in 2 days, mailing it to the Physical Review on February 7th. Resonance in uranium and thorium disintegrations and the phenomenon of nuclear fission was nevertheless written with care, more care than it received in the reading. Everyone understood its basic hypothesis that U-235, not U-238, is responsible for slow neutron fission in uranium, though not everyone concurred without the confirmation of experiment. But probably because, as Fermi recalled, isotopes at that time were considered almost magically inseparable, everyone overlooked its further implications. Szilard explained to Lewis Strauss that month that slow neutrons seem to split a uranium isotope, which is present in an abundance of about 1% in uranium. Richard Roberts at the DTM, in a 1940 draft report of considerable significance, asserted that Bohr ascribed the slow neutron reaction to U-235 and the fast neutron reaction to U-238. Roberts' misstatement was probably no more than a rough first approximation that he would have corrected in a polished report. Szilard's and Roberts' comments illustrate, however, that the slow neutron fission of U-235 preoccupied the physicists at first to the exclusion of a more ominous potentiality. Bohr acknowledged it indirectly in his paper for the Physical Review. The slow neutron fission of U-235 occupied the foreground of his discussion because it explained the puzzling difference between uranium and thorium. But Bohr also considered U-235's behavior under fast neutron bombardment. For fast neutrons, he wrote near the end of the paper, because of the scarcity of the isotope concerned, the fission yields will be much smaller than those obtained from neutron impacts on the abundant isotope. The statement implies, but does not ask a pregnant question. what would the yields be for fast neutrons if U-235 could be separated from U-238? The latest incarnation of Orso Corbino's garden fish pond in Rome was a tank of water 3 feet wide and 3 feet deep that Fermi and Anderson set up that winter in the basement of Pupin Hall. They planned to insert a radon beryllium neutron source into the center of a 5-inch spherical bulb and suspend the bulb in the middle of the tank. Neutrons from the beryllium would then diffuse through the surrounding water, which would slow them down. The neutrons would induce a characteristic 44-second half-life in strips of rhodium foil, Fermi's favorite neutron detector, set at various distances away from the bulb. Once he established a baseline of neutron activity using the Rn plus Be source alone, Fermi intended to pack uranium oxide into the bulb around the source and make a second series of measurements. If more neutrons turned up in the water tank with uranium than without, he could deduce that uranium produced secondary neutrons when it fissioned, and could roughly estimate their number. One neutron out for each neutron in was not enough to sustain a chain reaction, since inevitably some would be captured and others drift away. It needed something more than one secondary for each primary, preferably at least two. Upstairs on the 7th floor, Szilard discovered a different experiment in progress. Walter Zinn, a tall, blonde Canadian postdoctoral research associate who taught at City College, was bombarding uranium with 2.5 MeV neutrons from a small accelerator. He had reasoned in terms of neutron energy rather than quantity. He was trying to demonstrate secondary neutron production by looking for neutrons faster than the 2.5 MeVs he supplied. So far, he had managed only inconclusive results. "Szilard watched my experiment with great interest," Zinn recalls, "and then suggested that perhaps it would be more successful if lower energy neutrons were available. I said, that's fine, but where do you get them?" Leo said, "just leave it to me. I'll get them." Szilard meant to help Zinn, but he also coveted Zinn's ionization chamber. "All we needed to do," he said later, "was to get a gram of radium, get a block of beryllium, expose a piece of uranium to the neutrons which come from the beryllium, and then see by means of the ionization chamber which Zinn had built whether fast neutrons were emitted in the process. Such an experiment need not take more than an hour or two to perform once the equipment has been built, and if you have the neutron source. But, of course, we had no radium." The problem was still money. The Radium Chemical Company of New York and Chicago, a subsidiary of the Union Minière de Haute-Katanga of Belgium, the dominant source of world radium supplies, was willing to rent a gram of radium for a minimum of 3 months for $125 a month. Szilard wrote Louis Strauss at his Virginia farm on February 13th to see whether you could sanction the expenditures, and presciently briefed the financier on the meaning of the latest developments. The letter's crucial paragraph addresses Bohr's new hypothesis that U-235 is responsible for slow neutron fission in natural uranium. "If this isotope could be used for maintaining chain reactions, it would have to be separated from the bulk of uranium. This, no doubt, would be done if necessary, but it might take 5 to 10 years before it can be done on a technical scale. Should small-scale experiments show that the thorium and the bulk of uranium would not work, but the rare isotope of uranium would, we would have the task immediately to attack the question of concentrating the rare isotope of uranium." Strauss's surge generator losses had inoculated him against further investment in the nuclear enterprise. He wanted to know, Szilard says, "just how sure I was that this would work." Since Szilard could offer no guarantees, Strauss offered no support. Szilard turned then to Benjamin Leibowitz. He was not poor, but he was not exactly wealthy. "I told him what this was all about, and he said, 'How much money do you need?' I said, 'Well, I'd like to borrow $2,000. He took out his checkbook He wrote out a check, I cashed the check, I rented the radium, and in the meantime the beryllium block arrived from England. The cylinder of beryllium, which Walter Zinn thought a strange and unique object, and took for proof of Szilard's magic ways, arrived on February 18th, the same day Szilard heard from Teller about significant work in Washington at the DTM. Richard Roberts and R.C. Meyer were preparing a letter to the Physical Review reporting the discovery of delayed neutrons from fission. These were not the instantaneous secondary neutrons the Columbia researchers were seeking, but they did confirm that fission fragments had neutrons to spare and would give them up spontaneously. The general excitement Teller found at the busy DTM laboratories impressed him more. As soon as I began taking interest in uranium, sharp discussion started on the practical significance. Tuve, Hofstad, and Roberts are entirely aware of what is involved. They also know of Fermi's experiments. Of course, I didn't say anything. The above-mentioned letter to the Physical Review cannot cause any harm. I do not know their detailed plans, but I believe that urgent action to maintain secrecy is required. Very many people have discovered already what is involved. Those in Washington would like to persuade the Carnegie Institution that it should provide more money for U research in view of the practical significance of the matter. But right now, this has no reality unless the Carnegie leadership becomes more interested than it has been so far. I repeat that there is a chain reaction mood in Washington. I only had to say uranium, and then could listen for 2 hours to their thoughts. The president of the Carnegie Institution was a New England Yankee, the grandson of two sea captains, an electrical engineer, inventor, and former dean of the School of Engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, named Vannevar Bush. If Bush was initially less willing to invest in chain reaction experiments than Teller would have liked him to be, he kept good company. Neither Ernest Lawrence at Berkeley, nor Otto Hahn in Dahlem, nor Lise Meitner, visiting Copenhagen that February to work with Otto Frisch, chose to pursue moonshine. Only Columbia and Paris mounted early experiments, though the DTM would soon follow the Columbia lead. Frederick Joliot and two colleagues, a cultivated Austrian named Hans von Halban and a huge, keen Russian named Lou Kowarski, began an experiment similar to Fermi's the last week in February to identify secondary neutrons from fission. They also used a tank of water with a central neutron source, but dissolved their uranium in the water rather than packing it around the source. More important to their priority of research, they had immediate access to the Radium Institute's ample radium supply. Because Fermi's neutron source relied on radon rather than radium, it induced an ambiguity into his experiment that Szilard caught and called to his attention. Radon ejected much faster neutrons from beryllium than did radium. At least part of any increase in neutrons Fermi found in his tank might therefore result not from fission, but from another competing reaction in beryllium. Fermi thought the ambiguity trivial, but agreed, as Zinn had before, to repeat the experiment using a radium-beryllium source. Szilard generously offered his. But the radium to energize it was not yet in hand. Szilard was still negotiating its rental because his lack of official affiliation made the radium chemical company nervous. He got his radium, 2 grams, sealed in a small brass capsule early in March, after he arranged admission to the Columbia Laboratories for 3 months as a guest researcher. He and Zinn immediately set up their experiment. They made an ingenious nest, like Chinese boxes, of its various components. A large cake of paraffin wax, the beryllium cylinder set at the bottom of a blind hole in the paraffin, the radium capsule fitted into the beryllium cylinder. Resting on the beryllium inside the paraffin, a box lined with neutron-absorbing cadmium filled with uranium oxide. Pushed into that box, but shielded from the radium's gamma radiation by a lead plug, the ionization tube itself, which connected to an oscilloscope. With this arrangement, says Szilard, they could measure the flux of neutrons from the uranium with and without the cadmium shield. Everything was ready, and all we had to do was to turn a switch, lean back, and watch the screen of a television tube. If flashes of light appeared on the screen, that would mean that neutrons were emitted in the fission process of uranium, and this in turn would mean that the large-scale liberation of atomic energy was just around the corner. We turned the switch and saw the flashes. We watched them for a little while, and then we switched everything off, and we went home. They had made a rough estimate of neutron production. We find the number of neutrons emitted per fission to be about 2. With radium available merely by picking up the phone, the French team a week earlier had found more than 1 neutron produced for each neutron absorbed. Fermi and Anderson estimated a yield of about 2 neutrons per each neutron captured. Szilard immediately alerted Wigner and Teller. Teller remembers the moment well. "I was at my piano, attempting, with the collaboration of a friend and his violin, to make Mozart sound like Mozart, when the telephone rang. It was Szilard, calling from New York. He spoke to me in Hungarian, and he said only one thing. I have found the neutrons." Szilard also wired Louis Strauss. "Performed today proposed experiment with beryllium block with striking result. Very large neutron emission found. Estimate chances for reaction now above 50%. Szilard had known what the neutrons would mean since the day he crossed the street in Bloomsbury, the shape of things to come. That night, he recalled later, "there was very little doubt in my mind that the world was headed for grief." Though he was still recovering from jaundice, Eugene Wigner responded vigorously to Szilard's disturbing news while a storm of betrayal broke over Central Europe. Hitler ordered the president and the foreign minister of Czechoslovakia to Berlin on March 14th and threatened to bomb Prague to rubble unless they surrendered their country. With the Nazi leader's encouragement, the Slovaks formally seceded from the Republic that day. Ruthenia, Czechoslovakia's narrow eastern extension along the Carpathians, also claimed independence as Carpatho-Ukraine, an exercise in grave robbing abruptly terminated the following morning when the fascist Hungary of Admiral Horthy invaded the new nation with German endorsement. Hitler flew in triumph to Prague. On March 16th, he decreed what was left of Czechoslovakia, Bohemia and Moravia, to be a German protectorate. The country that France and Great Britain had abandoned at Munich was partitioned without resistance. Wigner caught the train to New York. On the morning of March 16th, he met with Szilard, Fermi, and George Pegram in Pegram's office. Since at least the end of January, Szilard had been promoting a new version of his Bund. He called it the Association for Scientific Collaboration, to monitor research, collect and disperse funds, and maintain secrecy, a civilian organization that might guide the development of atomic energy. He had discussed it with Louis Strauss on the train to Washington, with Teller after the night of the hard bed, with Wigner in Princeton the weekend Bohr drew his graphs. As far as Wigner was concerned, the time for such amateurism was over. "He strongly appealed to us," says Szilard, "immediately to inform the United States government of these discoveries. It was such a serious business that we could not assume responsibility for handling it." At 63, George Braxton Pegram was a generation older than the 2 Hungarians and the Italian who debated in his office that morning. A South Carolinian who had earned his Ph.D. from Columbia in 1903 working with thorium, he had studied under Max Planck at the University of Berlin and corresponded with Ernest Rutherford when Rutherford was still progressing in fruitful exile at McGill. Pegram was tall and athletic, a champion at tennis well into his 60s, a canoeist when young who enjoyed paddling and sailing an 18-foot sponson around Manhattan Island. His interest in radioactivity may have been aroused by his father, a chemistry professor. "Probably the most important problem before the physicist today," the senior Pegram told the North Carolina Academy of Sciences in 1911, is that of making the enormous energy within the atom available for the world's work. The next year, an associate professor of physics at Columbia, Pegram, had written Albert Einstein, encouraging him to come to New York to lecture on relativity theory. Pegram had brought Rabi and Fermi to Columbia, building the university's international reputation for nuclear research. He was gray now, with thinning hair, wire-rimmed glasses, protuberant ears, a strong, square, wide-chinned jaw. Radioactivity intrigued him still, but a university dean's well-worn conservatism counseled him to caution. He knew someone in Washington, he told Wigner. Charles Edison, Undersecretary of the Navy. Wigner insisted Pegram immediately call the man. Pegram was willing to do so, but first the group should discuss logistics. Who would carry the news? Fermi was traveling to Washington that afternoon to lecture in the evening to a group of physicists. He could meet with the Navy the next day. His Nobel Prize should give him exceptional credibility. Pegram called Washington. Edison was unavailable. His office directed Pegram to Admiral Stanford C. Hooper, technical assistant to the Chief of Naval Operations. Hooper agreed to hear Fermi out. Pegram's call was the first direct contact between the physicists of nuclear fission and the United States government. The next topic on the morning's agenda was secrecy. Fermi and Szilard had both written reports on their secondary neutron experiments and were ready to send them to the Physical Review. With Pegram's concurrence, they decided to go ahead and mail the reports to the review to establish priority, but to ask the editor to delay publishing them until the secrecy issue could be resolved. Both papers went off that day. Pegram prepared a letter of introduction for Fermi to carry along to his appointment. It stated a hesitant case, dense with hypotheticals. Experiments in the physics laboratory at Columbia University reveal that conditions may be found under which the chemical element uranium may be able to liberate its large excess of atomic energy, and that this might mean the possibility that uranium might be used as an explosive that would liberate 1,000,000 times as much energy per pound as any known explosive. My own feeling is that the probabilities are against this, but my colleagues and I think that the bare possibility should not be disregarded. Thus, lightly armed, Fermi departed to engage the Navy. The debate was hardly ended, nor Wigner's long day done. He returned to Princeton with Szilard in tow for an important meeting with Niels Bohr. It had been planned in advance. John Wheeler and Leon Rosenfeld would attend, and Teller was making a special trip up from Washington. If Bohr could be convinced to swing his prestige behind secrecy, the campaign to isolate German nuclear physics research might work. They met in the evening in Wigner's office. Szilard outlined the Columbia data, Wheeler reports, and the preliminary indications from it that at least 2 secondary neutrons emerge from each neutron-induced fission. Did this not mean that a nuclear explosive was certainly possible? Not necessarily, Bohr countered. We tried to convince him, Teller writes, that we should go ahead with fission research, but we should not publish the results. We should keep the results secret, lest the Nazis learn of them and produce nuclear explosions first. Bohr insisted that we would never succeed in producing nuclear energy, and he also insisted that secrecy must never be introduced into physics. Bohr's skepticism, says Wheeler, concerned the enormous difficulty of separating the necessary quantities of U-235. Fermi noted in a later lecture that it was not very clear in 1939 that the job of separating large amounts of uranium-235 was one that could be taken seriously. At the Princeton meeting, Teller remembers, Bohr insisted that it can never be done unless you turn the United States into one huge factory. More crucial for Bohr was the issue of secrecy. He had worked for decades to shape physics into an international community, a model within its limited franchise of what a peaceful, politically united world might be. Openness was its fragile, essential charter, an operational necessity, as freedom of speech is an operational necessity to a democracy. Complete openness enforced absolute honesty. The scientist reported all his results, favorable and unfavorable, where all could read them, making possible the ongoing correction of error. Secrecy would revoke that charter and subordinate science as a political system,
Polanyi's republic,
to the anarchic competition of the nation-states. No one was more anguished than Bohr by the menace of Nazi Germany. Laura Fermi remembers of this period, 2 months after his landing in the United States, that he spoke about the doom of Europe in increasingly apocalyptic terms, and his face was that of a man haunted by one idea. If U-235 could be separated easily from U-238, that misfortune might be cause for temporary compromise with principle in the interest of survival. Bohr thought the technology looked not even remotely accessible. The meeting dragged on inconclusively past midnight. The next afternoon, Fermi turned up at the Navy Department on Constitution Avenue for his appointment with Admiral Hooper. He had probably planned a conservative presentation. The contempt of the desk officer who went in to announce him to the Admiral encouraged that approach. "There's a WOP outside," Fermi overheard the man say. So much for the authority of the Nobel Prize. In what Louis Strauss, by now a Navy volunteer, calls a ramshackle old boardroom, Hooper assembled an audience of naval officers, officers from the Army's Bureau of Ordnance, and two civilian scientists attached to the Naval Research Laboratory. One of the civilians, a bluff physicist named Ross Gunn, had watched Richard Roberts demonstrate fission in the target room of the 5MV Van de Graaff at the DTM not long after Fermi passed through at the time of the 5th Washington Conference. Gunn worked on submarine propulsion. He was eager to learn more about an energy source that burned no oxygen. Fermi led his auditors through an hour of neutron physics. If the notes of one of the participants, a naval officer, are comprehensive, Fermi emphasized his water tank measurements rather than Szilard's more direct ionization chamber work. New experiments in preparation might confirm a chain reaction, Fermi explained. The problem, then, would be to assemble a sufficiently large mass of uranium to capture and use the secondary neutrons before they escaped through the surface of the material. The officer taking notes interrupted. What might be the size of this mass? Would it fit into the breech of a gun? Rather than look at physics down a gun barrel, Fermi withdrew to the ultra-mundane. It might turn out to be the size of a small star, he said, smiling and knowing better. Neutrons diffusing through a tank of water. It was all too vague. Except to alert Ross Gunn, the meeting came to nothing. Enrico himself doubted the relevance of his predictions, says Laura Fermi. The Navy reported itself interested in maintaining contact. Representatives would undoubtedly visit the Columbia premises. Fermi smelled the condescension and cooled. March 17th was a Friday. Szilard traveled down to Washington from Princeton with Teller. Fermi stayed the weekend. They got together, reports Szilard, to discuss whether or not these things, the physical review papers, should be published. Both Teller and I thought that they should not. Fermi thought that they should. But after a long discussion, Fermi took the position that after all, this was a democracy. If the majority was against publication, he would abide by the wish of the majority. Within a day or two, the issue became moot. The group learned of the Joliot-Von Halben-Kowarski paper published in Nature on March 18th. From that moment on, Szilard notes, Fermi was adamant that withholding publication made no sense. The following month, on April 22nd, Joliot, von Halben, and Kowarski published a second paper in Nature concerning secondary neutrons. This one, "Number of Neutrons Liberated in the Nuclear Fission of Uranium," rang bells. Calculating on the basis of the experiment previously reported, the French team found 3.5 secondary neutrons per fission. The interest of the phenomenon discussed here as a means of producing a chain of nuclear reactions, the three men wrote, was already mentioned in our previous letter. Now they concluded that if a sufficient amount of uranium were immersed in a suitable moderator, the fission chain will perpetuate itself and break up only after reaching the walls limiting the medium. Our experimental results show that this condition will most probably be satisfied. That is, uranium would most probably chain react. Julios was an authoritative voice. G.P. Thompson, J.J.'s son, who was professor of physics at Imperial College London, heard it. "I began to consider carrying out certain experiments with uranium," he told a correspondent later. "What I had in mind was something rather more than a piece of pure research, for at the back of my thoughts there lay the possibility of a weapon." He applied forthwith to the British Air Ministry for a ton of uranium oxide, ashamed of putting forward a proposal apparently so absurd. More ominously, two initiatives originated simultaneously in Germany as a result of the French report. A physicist at Göttingen alerted the Reich Ministry of Education. That led to a secret conference in Berlin on April 29th, which led in turn to a research program, a ban on uranium exports, and provision for supplies of radium from the Czechoslovakian mines at Joachimstal. Otto Hahn was invited to the conference, but arranged to be elsewhere. The same week, a young physicist working at Hamburg, Paul Hartek, wrote a letter jointly with his assistant to the German War Office. "We take the liberty of calling to your attention the newest development in nuclear physics, which, in our opinion, will probably make it possible to produce an explosive many orders of magnitude more powerful than the conventional ones. That country which first makes use of it has an unsurpassable advantage over the others." The Hartek letter reached Kurt Diebner, a competent nuclear physicist, stuck unhappily in the Wehrmacht's ordnance department studying high explosives. Diebner carried it to Hans Geiger. Geiger recommended pursuing the research. The War Office agreed.
A public debate in Washington on April 29th paralleled the secret conference in Berlin.
The New York Times account accurately summarizes the divisions in the U.S. physics community at the time. "Tempers and temperatures increase visibly today among members of the American Physical Society as they close their spring meeting with arguments over the probability of some scientist blowing up a sizable portion of the Earth with a tiny bit of uranium, the element which produces radium." Dr. Niels Bohr of Copenhagen, a colleague of Dr. Albert Einstein at the Institute for Advanced Study, Princeton, New Jersey, declared that bombardment of a small amount of the pure isotope U-235 of uranium with slow neutron particles of atoms would start a chain reaction, or atomic explosion, sufficiently great to blow up a laboratory and the surrounding country for many miles. Many physicists declared, however, that it would be difficult, if not impossible, to separate isotope 235 from the more abundant isotope 238. The isotope 235 is only 1% of the uranium element. Dr. L. Onsager of Yale University described, however, a new apparatus in which, according to his calculations, the isotopes of elements can be separated in gaseous form in tubes, which are cooled on one side and heated to high temperatures on the other. Other physicists argued that such a process would be almost prohibitively expensive, and that the yield of isotope 235 would be infinitesimally small. Nevertheless, they pointed out that if Dr. Onsager's process of separation should work, the creation of a nuclear explosion, which would wreck as large an area as New York City, would be comparatively easy. A single neutron particle, striking the nucleus of a uranium atom, they declared, would be sufficient to set off a chain reaction of millions of other atoms. The Times story assumes the truth of Bohr's argument in favor of U-235, although even Bohr was apparently still emphasizing only a slow neutron reaction. Fermi and others were not yet convinced of U-235's role. The two uranium isotopes might not easily be separated in quantity, but it had occurred to John Dunning earlier in the month that they could be separated in microscopic amounts in Alfred Nier's mass spectrograph. Dunning had immediately written Nyer a long, impassioned letter asking him, in effect, to resolve the dispute between Fermi and Bohr and push chain reaction research dramatically forward. Nyer, Dunning, and Fermi all attended the American Physical Society meeting. In person, Dunning urged Nyer to try for a separation, much as he had urged him in the key paragraph of his letter. "There is one line of attack that deserves strong effort, and that is where we need your cooperation. It is of the utmost importance to get some uranium isotopes separated in enough quantities for a real test. If you could separate effectively even tiny amounts of the two main isotopes, a third isotope, U-234, is present in natural uranium to the trace extent of 1 part in 17,000. There is a good chance that Eugene T. Booth and I could demonstrate, by bombarding them with the cyclotron, which isotope is responsible. There is no other way to settle this business. If we could all cooperate, and you aid us by separating some samples, then we could, by combining forces, settle the whole matter." The important point for Dunning, the reason for his passion, was that if U-235 was responsible for slow neutron fission, then its fission cross-section must be 139 times as large as the slow neutron fission cross-section of natural uranium, since it was present in the natural substance to the extent of only 1 part in 140. By separating the 235 isotope, Herbert Anderson emphasizes in a memoir, it would be much easier to obtain the chain reaction. More than this, with the separated isotope, the prospect for a bomb with unprecedented explosive power would be very great. Fermi urged Nyer in similar terms. Nyer recalls that he went back and figured out how we might soup up our apparatus some in order to increase the output. "I did work on the problem, but at first it seemed like such a far-fetched thing that I didn't work on it as hard as I might have. It was just one of a number of things I was trying to do." Fermi, in any case, was more interested in pursuing a chain reaction in natural uranium than in attempting to separate isotopes. "He was not discouraged by the small cross-section for fission in the natural element," comments Anderson. "Stay with me," he advised. "We'll work with natural uranium. You'll see. We'll be the first to make the chain reaction." I stuck with Fermi. By mid-April, Szilard had managed to borrow about 500 pounds of black, grimy uranium oxide free of charge from the El Dorado Radium Corporation, an organization owned by the Russian-born Pregel brothers, Boris and Alexander. Boris had studied at the Radium Institute in Paris. El Dorado speculated in rare minerals and owned important uranium deposits at Great Bear Lake in the Northwest Territories of Canada. Like Fermi's and Anderson's previous experiment, the new project involved measuring neutron production in a tank of liquid. For a more accurate reading, the experimenters needed a longer exposure time than their customary rhodium foils activated to 44-second half-life would allow. They planned instead simply to fill the tank with a 10% solution of manganese, an iron-like metal that gives amethyst its purple color and that activates upon neutron bombardment to an isotope with a nearly 3-hour half-life. The radioactivity induced in manganese, they explained afterward in their report, is proportional to the number of slow neutrons present. So the hydrogen in the water would serve to slow both the primary neutrons from the central neutron source and any secondary neutrons from fission, and the manganese in the water would serve to measure them. A nice economy of design. Atoms on the surface of a mass of uranium are exposed to neutrons more efficiently than atoms deeper inside. Fermi and Szilard therefore decided not to bulk their 500 pounds of uranium oxide into one large container, but to distribute it throughout the tank by packing it into 52 cans as tall and narrow as lengths of pipe, 2 inches in diameter, and 2 feet long. Packing cans and mixing manganese solutions, which had to be changed and the manganese concentrated after each experimental run, was work. So was staying up half the night taking readings of manganese radioactivity. Fermi accepted the challenge with gusto. "He liked to work harder than anyone else," Anderson notes, but everyone worked very hard. Except Szilard. Szilard thought he ought to spend his time thinking. Fermi was insulted. Szilard made a mortal sin, Segre remembers, echoing Fermi. He said, "Oh, I don't want to work and dirty my hands like a painter's assistant." When Szilard announced that he had hired a stand-in, a young man whom Anderson remembers as very competent, Fermi acceded to the arrangement without comment, but he never again pursued an experiment jointly with Szilard. In the arrangement, as finally consummated, Szilard's RA and BE source stands in the center of the tank, which holds 143 gallons of manganese solution. The 52 cans of UO2 gather around. It worked. The three physicists found neutron activity about 10% higher with uranium oxide than without it. This result shows that in our arrangement, more neutrons are emitted by uranium than are absorbed by uranium. But the experiment raised puzzling questions. Resonance absorption, for example, was clearly a problem, capturing neutrons that might otherwise serve the chain reaction. The report estimates an average emission of secondary neutrons of about 1.2 neutrons per thermal neutron, but notes that this number should be increased to perhaps 1.5 because some of the neutrons had obviously been captured without fissioning, demonstrating the big capture resonance around 25 eV that Bohr had attributed on his graphs to U-238. Another problem was the use of water as a moderator. As Fermi's team had discovered in Rome in 1934, hydrogen was more efficient than any other element at slowing down neutrons, and slow neutrons avoided the parasitic capture resonance of U-238. But hydrogen itself also absorbed some slow neutrons, reducing further the number available for fission. And it was already clear that every possible secondary neutron would have to be husbanded carefully if a chain reaction was to be initiated in natural uranium. George Plotcheck came down from Cornell, where he had found a new home, for a visit, looked over the arrangement, and insightfully foreclosed its future. As Szilard tells it, "We were inclined to conclude that the water-uranium system would sustain a chain reaction. Plotcheck said that our conclusion was wrong, because in order to make a chain reaction go, we would have to eliminate the absorption of neutrons by the water. That is, we would have to reduce the amount of water in the system, and if we reduce the water in the system, we would increase the parasitic absorption of neutrons by uranium, because with less water, fewer neutrons would be slowed. He recommended that we abandon the water-uranium system and use helium for slowing down the neutrons. To Fermi, this sounded funny, and Fermi referred to helium thereafter invariably as Plotcheck's helium." In June, the Columbia team wrote up its experiment and sent the resulting paper, Neutron Production and Absorption in Uranium, to the Physical Review, which received it on July 3rd. Fermi left for the Summer School of Theoretical Physics at Ann Arbor. His attention diverted, says Anderson, by an interesting problem in cosmic rays. Either Fermi did not share Szilard's sense of the urgency of chain reaction research, or he was withdrawing for a time from the Navy's indifference and Plotcheck's persuasive criticism of his uranium water system. Probably both. Anderson settled down to study resonance absorption in uranium, a project that would evolve into his doctoral dissertation. Szilard remained in the steamy city. "I was left alone in New York. I still had no position at Columbia. My 3 months of laboratory privileges were up. But there were no experiments going on anyway, and all I had to do was think." Szilard thought first about an alternative to water. The next common material up the periodic table that might work, that had a capture cross-section considerably smaller than hydrogen's, that was cheap, that would be thermally and chemically stable, was carbon. The mineral form of carbon, chemically identical to diamond, but the product of a different structure of crystallization, is graphite, a black, greasy, opaque, lustrous material that is the essential component of pencil lead. Although carbon slows neutrons much less rapidly than hydrogen, even that difference might be put to advantage by careful design. Louis Strauss was leaving for Europe the week of July 2nd, hoping that the financier might coax support for uranium research from Belgium's Union Minière. Szilard sent Strauss a last-minute letter arguing that a chain reaction in uranium is an immediate possibility, but chose not to mention his new uranium-graphite conception. Apparently, he wanted to discuss it first with Fermi. The same day, July 3rd, he wrote the Italian laureate at length. "It seems to me now," he reported, "that there is a good chance that carbon might be an excellent element to use in place of hydrogen, and there is a strong temptation to gamble on this chance." He wanted to try a large-scale experiment with a carbon-uranium oxide mixture as soon as they could acquire enough material. In the meantime, he thought he would set up a small experiment to measure more accurately carbon's capture cross-section, only the upper limit of which was then known. If carbon should prove unsuitable, their next best guess might be heavy water, rich in deuterium, though they would need a few tons of that scarce and expensive liquid. Deuterium, H2, has a much smaller cross-section for neutron capture than ordinary hydrogen. Across the 163rd anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, Szilard's ideas evolved rapidly. On July 5th, he visited the National Carbon Company of New York to look into purchasing graphite blocks of high purity, because impurities such as boron with large capture cross-sections would soak up too many neutrons. He wrote Fermi his finding the same day. "It seems that it will be possible to get sufficiently pure carbon at a reasonable price." He also mentioned arranging the uranium and carbon in layers. Fermi sat down in Ann Arbor at the end of the week to respond to Szilard's first report. Independently, he had arrived at a similar plan. "Thank you for your letter. I was also considering the possibility of using carbon for slowing down the neutrons. According to my estimates, a possible recipe might be about 39,000 kilograms of carbon mixed with 600 kilograms of uranium. If it were really so, the amounts of materials would certainly not be too large." Since, however, the amount of uranium that can be used, especially in a homogeneous mixture, is exceedingly small, perhaps the use of thick layers of carbon, separated by layers of uranium, might allow use of a somewhat larger percentage of uranium. The idea of layering, or in some other way separating the uranium from the graphite, originated in calculations Fermi made in June for the manganese water tank experiment. Fermi's calculations led both men to consider partitioning the oxide from the graphite in the new design they were independently evolving. Partitioning would give the fast secondary neutrons room to slow down, bouncing around in the moderator before they encountered any U-238 nuclei. Szilard's next letter, on July 8th, mentions that the carbon and the uranium oxide would not be mixed but built up in layers, or in any case used in some canned form. Both the July 5th and July 8th letters apparently crossed with Fermi's letter in the mail. By the time he heard from Fermi, Szilard had seen still farther and realized that small spheres of uranium arranged within blocks of graphite would be even more favorable from the point of view of a chain reaction than the system of plain uranium layers, which was initially considered. The arrangement Szilard had in mind he called a lattice. A geodesic dome would represent such a lattice arrangement schematically if it were a complete sphere, and if all its interior volume were filled like its surface with evenly spaced points. His calculations indicated somewhat larger volumes of material than had Fermi's, perhaps 50 tons of carbon and 5 tons of uranium. The entire experiment, he thought, would cost about $35,000. If a chain reaction would work in graphite and uranium, Szilard assumed, then a bomb was probable. And if he had managed these conclusions, he further assumed, then so had his counterparts in Nazi Germany. He sought out Pegram in those early July days and tried to convince him of the urgent need for a large-scale experiment to settle the question. The dean resisted the assault. He took the position that even though the matter appeared to be rather urgent, this being summer and Fermi being away, there was really nothing that usefully could be done until the fall. For several weeks, Szilard had been trying on his own to raise funds from the U.S. military. In late May, he had asked Wigner to contact the Army's Aberdeen Proving Ground, its weapons development facility in Maryland. While he was thinking through the possibilities of a uranium graphite system, he had talked to Ross Gunn about Navy support. Now, Fermi's letter of July 9th and a July 10th letter from Gunn arrived to discourage him. Fermi wrote of layering the carbon and uranium, but calculated in terms of a homogeneous system of graphite and uranium oxide crushed and mixed together. Szilard concluded he was being mocked. I knew very well that Fermi computed the homogeneous mixture only because it was the easiest to compute. This showed me that Fermi did not take this really seriously. Gunn, in turn, reported that it seems almost impossible to carry through any sort of an agreement with the Navy that would be really helpful to you. I regret this situation, but see no escape. Despite his Olympian ego, not even Leo Szilard felt capable of saving the world entirely alone. He called on his Hungarian compatriots now for moral support. Edward Teller had moved to Manhattan for the summer to teach physics at Columbia. Eugene Wigner came up from Princeton to conspire with them. In later years, Szilard would recount several different versions of how their conversation went, but a letter he wrote on August 15, 1939, offers reliable contemporary testimony. Dr. Wigner is taking the stand that it is our duty to enlist the cooperation of the Roosevelt administration. A few weeks ago, he came to New York in order to discuss this point with Dr. Teller and me. Szilard had shown Wigner his uranium graphite calculations. He was impressed, and he was concerned. Both Teller and Wigner, Szilard wrote in a background memorandum in 1941, shared the opinion that no time must be lost in following up this line of development, and in the discussion that followed, the opinion crystallized that an attempt ought to be made to enlist the support of the government rather than that of private industry. Dr. Wigner, in particular, urged very strongly that the government of the United States be advised. But the discussion slipped away from that project into worry about what would happen if the Germans got hold of large quantities of the uranium which the Belgians were mining in the Congo. Perhaps Szilard emphasized the futility of the government contacts that he and Fermi had already made. So we began to think, through what channels could we approach the Belgian government and warn them against selling any uranium to Germany? It occurred to Szilard then that his old friend Albert Einstein knew the Queen of Belgium. Einstein had met Queen Elizabeth in 1929 on a trip to Antwerp to visit his uncle. Thereafter, the physicist and the sovereign maintained a regular correspondence, Einstein addressing her in plain-spoken letters simply as Queen. The Hungarians were aware that Einstein was summering on Long Island. Szilard proposed visiting Einstein and asking him to alert Elizabeth of Belgium. Since Szilard owned no car and had never learned to drive, he enlisted Wigner to deliver him. They called Einstein's office at the Institute for Advanced Study and learned he was staying at a summer house on Old Grove Pond on Nassau Point, the spit of land that divides Little from Great Peconic Bay on the northeastern arm of the island. They called Einstein to arrange a day. At this time, Szilard also furthered Wigner's proposal to contact the United States government by seeking advice from a knowledgeable émigré economist, Gustav Solper, a Berliner resettled in New York who had once been a member of the Reichstag. Solper offered to try to identify an influential messenger. Wigner picked up Szilard on the morning of Sunday, July 16th, and drove out Long Island to Peconic. They reached the area in early afternoon, but had no luck soliciting